about fly fishing internet radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Joe Howell, and he'll be answering your questions on fly fishing the legendary North Umpqua for steelhead. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the internet. If you'd like to ask Joe a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future live broadcasts. Just fill out the form on the right side of our homepage, and we'll let you know when the next live show will be. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website about 48 hours after the show ends. You can also find it on any of the podcast sites like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Casts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website or any of the podcast platforms at your convenience and listen to the recording at any time. If you're out and about on Facebook, Instagram, or X, we'd sure appreciate it if you could share our podcasts. And when you do, use hashtag AskAboutFlyFishing and hashtag FlyFishing. If, in fact, you have a moment, if you wouldn't mind doing that right now, we'd really appreciate it. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. When we return, we'll be talking with Joe Howell about fly fishing the legendary North Umpqua for steelhead. Fly Fishers International needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. The organization provides grants to help with the restoration of habitats like Wolf Creek in Idaho, and Sands Creek in Delaware County, New York, and funds projects that collect valuable data about fish and their habitats like a peacock bass study in Miami, Florida. FFI serves as a strong advocate for fly fishing in all waters for all fish to preserve and to promote the arts of fly casting and fly tying and to help ensure future generations can continue to enjoy these one-of-a-kind experiences. These efforts won't be nearly as effective without your help. If you're not already a member, we invite you to join Fly Fishers International as they work to cultivate conservation, education, and community within the sport of fly fishing. Join Fly Fishers International today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to their website at flyfishersinternational.org. Again, that's flyfishersinternational.org. Before we introduce Joe, we'd like to let you know about the great prizes we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under tonight's section that says Register for a Free Drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We will also be giving away a copy of Joe's book, Fly Fishing Guide to the North Umpqua, courtesy of Stackpole Books. Now, to find out more about what Stackpole has to offer, you can go to stackpolebooks.com and see all the publications they have on fly fishing and other subjects as well. We also have a link to Joe's book on the homepage tonight, so if you want to take a look there, you can take a look there as well. Now, here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question I ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something that Joe and I talk about during the show. And you must submit your answer along with your name and location in the text box on our homepage. So listen closely. Use your best typing skills. Take notes. Type fast. And maybe you'll be the proud winner of Joe's book, Fly Fishing Guide to the North Umpqua. Tonight, our guest is Joe Howell. The North Umpqua has been Joe's passion since he first fished it when he was 8 years old. He had the privilege of living on this river with his wife for 45 years. He enjoyed sharing his love of fly fishing through 30 years of guiding and by owning the Blue Heron Fly Shop. During that time, he created many new steelhead fly patterns. Though now retired, he is still active in the fly fishing community and enjoys coming up with creative patterns and sharing them with other fly fishermen. He is a contract tire for Umpqua Feather Merchants, where his Starlight Leech, Joe's Prawn, Coon Muddler, and Tiger Paw are produced and sold commercially. The Starlight Leech can still be found in many of the fly shops and is one of the most copied and productive patterns for steelhead and salmon. He received the Oregon Council of the Federation of Fly Fishermen's Fly Tire of the Year Award in 1992. Joe, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, good to have you and talk about steelhead. Those hard-to-catch little buggers, right?
They are hard to catch, and I always tell people, you mean there's another type of fish?
Oh, gosh.
No, and I fish a lot of different
fish.
Oh,
boy.
Anyway, yeah, that's been my passion, steelhead.
Yeah, yeah. Well, your relationship with the North Umpqua began during family trout fishing trips. What do you remember about those first encounters with the river, and how did it affect you?
Well, I was right around 8 years old when I first started coming up with my folks and my aunt and uncle. And after Idlewild Park, right around the area of where Baker Park is now, there on up it was still gravel road. And up past Steamboat was still gravel road. I remember sections above the upper river that was just dirt road, and they still had bulldozers pushing dirt and rocks into the water, which, of course, they couldn't do today. But so those are some of my earliest memories, and I was tying primarily trout flies. I remember my first 15-inch trout, which was the biggest trout I'd ever caught at that time, I think I was like 11 or 12. I'd gotten a Boy Scout fly tying kit for my birthday, my 11th birthday. And it was a wonderful gift. I didn't realize that there was such a thing as hackle size or a certain hook or anything like that, or proportions. Anyway, I tied this bright blue chenille woolly worm with a size 2 badger hackle palmered on. And caught that 15-inch trout on that ugly old stringy fly. So that's kind of my first memories of trout fishing. And
yeah. Well, what began your fascination with steelhead then?
Oh, I was 14 or 15, still going up river. My dad drove log truck for 33 years. And when he was up on North Umpqua in the summer months, I would often have him drop me off at Steamboat, and he'd pick me up on his third and last trip down the mountain. And he'd come tooting his horn, and I'd scramble up the bank and have to be in a certain area at a certain time. And if I missed that, I slept in the bushes, you know, but I never missed the ride home. But I remember the first real encounter with steelhead, and it wasn't even on my line. My brother and I had gone up and had been dropped off, and we'd been fishing that day, and we were out at the station pool from the roadside and narrow little slot, and this guy comes wading across from the trail side, obviously that we were there, but I didn't know anything about fishing etiquette in those days. Obviously he didn't either. But anyway, he made a few casts literally right at my feet, and a few feet down he hooks this steelhead, and it arcs skyward in a big arching. It looked enormous, but now I realize it was probably about 8 pounds, and just all silver against the blue sky. That's the day I was hooked. I went, I'm going to have to leave the trout flies home and just carry steelhead flies if I want to start.
Yeah. Is the North Umpqua is known more for steelhead than trout fishing, but trout fishing is available there as well?
Yeah, trout fishing is available. It's all catch-release wild trout fishery. And there's a few hardcore trout fishermen that climb up and down the banks. The river's a lot of very steep banks. And so when I was guiding, I used to tell people it was a young man's river and how little I was writing my own future, you know.
Right, right.
There's places I'd love to go down, but they're just too big of boulders and too steep and can't wade well anymore. So, but I have a lot of memories, and that's a good thing.
Yeah. How did you started tying your own steelhead flies, right? And did that deepen your fascination with steelhead? Did it connect you closer? Or?
Yeah, it did. About that time when I was, I guess I was around 14 or so, I met I never knew his name. He was just like a Forest Service type that wore khaki shirt and khaki pants and a khaki hat and had snow white hair. That's all I remember about him. But always really friendly. And the first time I met him was at the Mott Bridge. And I was looking over the bridge like everybody does to see if there's any steelhead down in the pool. And he starts talking about flies. And I said, well, all I have is a bunch of these trout flies that are big enough. He said, no, you need something like this. And he pulls out this box of, it was a metal fly box, Wheatley, I think it was. And he opened that thing up, and then he had a little plastic box full of flies also. I never saw so many colors and sparkle silver tinsel and much larger hooks. They were tried on sixes and fours and twos. And he said, this is what you need for steelhead. And I bought some bigger hooks when I got home. Started tying steelhead flies. It's kind of my first introduction. Had several encounters with bad tackle and no fish to the beach for, oh, I imagine a couple of years. Had loops of line wrapped around my reel and my reel butt, and of course the line would straighten and it lost another one, you know. But I slowly learned. I got a better reel, one with a drag, and gosh, I think that first Luger 9500, I think it was a lot of money to me. It was $10.95.
$10.95.
Yeah.
Boy, you could buy one today for that, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Used market, they're like $50 for a good one, if it's a U.S. one, not the offshore one. And so then I started landing a few steelhead. But the first effects of the hatchery program hadn't really taken effect until I was in high school. I was a junior in high school. And my buddies would come up fishing. There used to be 2, 3, 4 of us. Way too many on a one-pool river type of deal. But we didn't catch a lot of steelhead. We had a lot of fun and learned a lot. And it was just a good time to be learning, you know, something totally different.
Were you learning just on your own, or did you have a mentor of some kind?
No, we just learned trial and error and started seeing where other fishermen were fishing, you know, that we were known steelhead fishermen. There weren't a whole lot of regular steelhead fishermen. Most of them are trout fishermen in those days, because they used to plant the river heavily with trout, which they haven't done for 30 years. But it was a trial and error thing, and we just started hooking fish where we saw other people fishing for them. And so we knew there were just certain lies and certain waters that they favored. There was one old guy, Frank Berg, who took a liking to us. And he'd pull over and he'd watch, and we'd come up and he'd talk to us. And he'd say, oh, you always do that. You know, this pool might be better this time of year. The water's too thin here, or it's too fast, or whatever. And so he was, if there was a mentor, he helped, even though it was hit and miss. But most of those old timers, they wouldn't give us a time of day.
You know, wow.
It's just the way steelhead fishermen are, even today. You ask them what fly they caught the fish on, it's like, you know, what do you need to know that for, you know? So I made a decision, and I told Dale one time when we went into Steamboat Inn, when Frank Moore still owned it, and there was a couple of guys who we knew by name, older gentlemen, and when we walked up, he grabbed his rod and put his hand over his fly. Well, we could clearly see it was a skunk fly. You know, there aren't that many black and white type flies. So I told Dale, I said, if I ever learn this game, I'm going to help anybody that wants help. So that's kind of where we got our start, and we've always kind of been that way.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about the history of the river a little bit. How did it become one of America's most historically important steelhead rivers?
Well, it was, I believe it was one of the first ones, because it was one of the first ones that was set aside to protect, there was 31 miles of river set aside for fly fishing only. And it wasn't primarily at first for the steelhead. They had closed it to protect the salmon run. But salmon just don't take flies readily at all that far inland. And they're dark and they're black by the time they, you know, summer rolls around. But the steelhead benefited from it. The steelhead fishing from the Steamboat Inn, it had a regular clientele that gradually built up over the years. Before that, it was Clarence Gordon's North Umpqua Lodge on the opposite side of the river, which the Forest Service canceled his lease, and he had to rebuild where the current Steamboat Inn is now. And he ran that as Steamboat Store for a few years during all the road building years. And then Frank Moore bought it, Steamboat Inn, from 1957. And it kind of took off from there as a destination. Well, I think it was just because it was first set aside as the first fly fishing area that held steelhead.
Well, what were some of the pioneers that fished the river, and what influence did they have on other anglers in the traditions that continue today?
Well, Zangrave visited the river for 3 summers until he had a stroke and he couldn't return, but he favored that above the Rogue, which had been one of his favorites. But he was, by today's money, he'd been a billionaire. So he fished all over the world, but he came to the Umpqua for 2 months a summer, brought his whole entourage, secretaries, cooks, camp, everything. But the real pioneers were people like Fred Burnham and I think his name was Bill Coleman. I can't remember if Bill was his right first name. There's a pool name after him. And then the Krogel brothers, who I fished with, they were probably in their 30s at the time, I would think. They were guiding in that steamboat area because the road was not built along the river at that time. It was high above the river, and it ended at Steamboat Creek, where there was a ranger station, or a guard station, really, just a small building. And so it was that's the only access. The boat pool got its name because they put canoes and small boats to ferry the people over to the camp area until, I think, Mott Bridge was completed in 1926. But then the road didn't go much past that other than being called the Umpqua Truck Road, which no public access was allowed through the road building back in the 30s. I've never read that it was.
So did Zane Gray's appearance bring more fly fishers into the area? I mean, was that...
No, he was pretty closed-mouthed. He was... He never talked... He talked about the Rogue and other places, but it wasn't until after he quit coming that he did a little writing about it. So it was... He didn't want people coming to the North Umpqua.
Yeah.
He wanted to keep it as pristine.
Keep it for himself.
Well, possibly, you know, but there was that. He unfortunately hired guides to hold certain pools that he wanted to fish that day, and they would stop any angler approaching it and say, "Well, you can't fish this. Mr. Gray's got to fish this later on."
Oh, geez.
So locally, he wasn't well-liked. He's a good writer and all that stuff, but that's the local lore. That's the local history of that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, one thing I thought was, because I don't think I've seen another book like yours, where you're going through almost every pool and riffle and everything in the, you know, along the river, and identifying them. And I guess, as I understood from your book, many of these pools were named back in the 20s, 30s, 40s, but the origins of some of the names have been lost. And by your book, you're trying to preserve some of those, right?
Exactly. And that's part of the reason, you know. It was That, I would have loved to have read stuff written by Clarence Gordon, who owned the First North Umpqua Lodge. And Ray Bergman did write a small chapter on the North Umpqua in his book Trout in 1938, when Clarence Gordon had invited him out to fish, and he came out two different summers. But it's in like in a Model T, and you break down a lot, you carry extra tires, and it was a long, long trek from the East Coast to where he was going. So they usually stayed for a month, as far as I understand. And he caught steelhead, and his early writings about that is really about the only thing out there. But they were pretty much confined with fishing the camp water, an area still known as the camp water. That's where the main fishing camps were. It was, it held an interest of mine. It was like one of two, three books that had anything about the North Umpqua River when I was 14, 15 years old. The first one was Van Fleet's book, Steelhead to a Fly, in 1950. And it was published in 1950. But it was a generic, this is the river, and this is the place you go in general, and these are a couple of my favorite flies, and you should probably fish on your own because the guides want $20 a day, and at best all they can do is show you where to go, you know.
Yeah.
Well, that's enormous on any river, is access trails and where to fish a run, where not to waste your time. So...
So the camp...
Those three books were only that and Claude Christ. Yeah. It just wasn't anything.
Yeah.
I don't think there is anything out there that has a pool-by-pool situation. If I wanted to preserve the names, when I might be jumping ahead of the questions here. But
that's all right.
When I had the shop, guys would come in all summer long, year after year. Well, you know, I keep their excitement built up, and what fly you catch it on, where'd you well, I don't know, but we called it Face Rock or Top Hat Rock or The Wall, and I went, gee, I've never heard of any of those names, you know. So once they described where they were camping and how far up they were, I said, oh, that's Rip Rap Point. Oh, that's what that's called. And they'd make a notation in their notebook about one in 20, you know. When I guided, I tried to get people to keep notes so they would remember. There's only 1 in 50 that did.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was good for business because they came back to ask me where.
Yeah. Where that place again?
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah, now, you said that camp water, it was that the center of the river's early fishing camps?
The early fishing. There was a place down by Susan Creek where the Boundary Road took off, and that put you into the North Umpqua Road proper before they built the highway. It was the old Circle H Ranch, and that burned down way before my time. But they would fish those waters that they could walk to from the lodge through, you know, I guess there's maybe a half a dozen, maybe eight area, depending on how far you wanted to brushwalk it and go down the river from that lodge. But they were just foot, you know, rough foot trails, game trails.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
And that side of the river had lots of poison oak, so it still does. So I don't frequent it much.
So when you say fishing camps back then, are these
places where
people camped, or were they?
No, they, well, Steamboat was a fishing camp until Clarence Gordon built the first North Umpqua Lodge, and he had it run it for a few years, and the only thing that remains of that today are a few archival black and white pictures, you know. But the Forest Service wanted that for a ranger station, that land, and so he moved over to Maple Ridge, which is just a promontory of hard basalt rock. So they had to actually find a spring on the other side of the river, lay an inch and a quarter cable, and attach a water line to get water to it. You know, it was a big ordeal.
But when you say camps, camps are like tent camps, places for people to camp. I mean, or
They
were
were
they?
rustic and unimproved.
Okay.
So about any flat place that you could clear would be a camp, you know.
Okay. All right.
Sometimes there was an area much bigger than just for a tent, you know,
Yeah.
campfire or something.
Right, right.
Right there at the boat pool proper above on that was the largest flat area. There were several camp areas there. And before, oh gosh, I had his name on the top of my head, now I forgot it. Before Gordon, there was a, Major Mott had a guide who I can't remember his name. He was a camp cook, he kind of did everything for him. Major Mott had, as far as I'm aware, had the first actual tent camp, and it was, for rustic standards, it was pretty nice. It wasn't a dirt floor. He had wood platforms built up, roll a carpet out, and a bed on a wooden platform, and then they put the tent, a large wall tent, on the wooden platform. And I've seen photographs of that, all black and white.
Yeah,
And
yeah.
Major Mott was first, and then Clarence Gordon was second, and Frank Moore was third.
Okay.
And then
Okay.
Jim Van Loan, and then the folks that have it now. But so it hasn't had a lot of owners or anything like that.
Yeah. Okay, time for us to take a quick break here, Joe. Hang on, and I'll be right back, and we'll talk more about fly fishing, the legendary North Umpqua River for steelhead.
Okay.
The Ugly Bug Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming has been serving fly fishers in Wyoming and around the world since 1983. The selection of top-of-the-line gear and a huge assortment of flies is one of the best in the land. All products are available in their fly shop and online. Looking for advice? Just give them a call and their expert professional staff will help you with whatever you need. Visit the Ugly Bug Fly Shop today at uglybugflyshop.com or call them at 866-845-9284. Again, it's the uglybugflyshop.com or call them at 866-845-9284. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Joe Howell about fly fishing the legendary North Umpqua River for steelhead. If you'd like to ask Joe a question, go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. Well, Joe, I always ask my guests what's going on in your fly fishing world, and I know you're retired, but you're still actively out there doing some speaking engagements and stuff, or tying
Oh,
them.
doing some fly tying things at some different shows, but there's one coming up in October at Grossburg Fairgrounds that's held by the Umpqua Valley Fly Fishers and the Umpqua Veterans Fly Fishing Group.
Okay.
So I'll be tying there. There's usually they try to get 60 or 70 tires. They try for 100, but about 60 or 70 sign up and about 50 show up. So that's just the way it usually works sometimes.
Okay. All right. Well, good. Anything else? Any other places you'd be tying or speaking?
No, not this
Okay.
year, just there.
Okay. Okay. All right, and again, tell people where it's at and what it's called.
That'd be at Roseburg Fairgrounds, October 24th, so Saturday
October.
only.
Okay. All right. Okay. Good. Good. Well, back to talking about the North Umpqua. You wrote that rivers with strong traditions are more likely to be remembered and protected. What parts of the North Umpqua's history are most important for today's anglers to carry forward?
I think the Campwater area will always be the main center. It was the first formal fishing area, but primarily because that's where the road ended so many years ago. Although there are steelhead up and down, with the river, like many rivers, has fallen on some lean times in the past couple of years. Actually, it closed the steelhead fishing this summer due to low returns. But we still have two generations in the ocean, and I guess they're blaming it on this super strong El Nino or something out in the ocean. We'll see. But we've had up and down years before. I remember the first year I moved up here from Roseburg. Well, I was rearing ready to go, because that's 45 years ago. But and the runs crashed. The river was still open. They still had 3,000 or 4,000 fish, but it wasn't the 8 or 10, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it went up and down for a few years, and then it started climbing for the next 8, 9 years, and then it leveled off, and then it went down, went up. So it's just what happens to steelhead rivers. They're very much mm-hmm. driven by habitat, drought, especially droughts, the amount of snowpack and the water in the secondary streams especially, and what's going on in the ocean. They've got to be able to find enough food. And the biologists tell us that most of our fish are 2 years in the freshwater and 2 years in the saltwater feeding before they come back for adults. But there's a small percentage of fish that'll be three salt fish. They'll spend 3 years in the ocean. And there's like 5% of those. Mm-hmm. Most of them are two salt fish. And there's an extremely rare fish that comes that spends 4 years in the ocean. He might have swam all the way to Russia and had a hard time getting back. I don't know. But they've got a lot of fishing nets to dodge.
Yeah. What's your water situation this year? Are you experiencing drought like we are here in the Rockies?
Yes. We had virtually no snowpack this year. So our mm-hmm. water levels are low. And they're warmer. We're like 68 degrees, which is
borderline, right?
Yeah, you know, it's not good. So that's one of the reasons they shut it down, too, is water temperatures.
Yeah.
But they left the river open to trout fishing, even though it's a catch-and-release fishery, but you can still go out and trout fish. But you better not be caught out there with a two-handed nine-weight, you know, trying to tell some game officer you're trout fishing, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about fishing the river. It's got a reputation of being difficult for a steelhead river. What are the three biggest, of course, steelhead is difficult anywhere you go, right?
Yes.
But what are the three biggest challenges a first-time angler must learn to overcome?
Well, on this river, it's there's so many different holding spots that aren't typical of cobble or gravel bar rivers, and you have to kind of learn those. And the high, fast water, I should say, that people aren't used to, mostly all bedrock. There are some gravel runs and cobble runs, but there are few. Most of it's bedrock, and much of it's unweightable. You have to be able to roll cast. If you can roll cast 30 or 40 feet, you can catch a steelhead, but if you could roll cast and control 60 or 70 feet, and with the right line and a single-handed rod, you can do that. Now, with two-handed rods, that makes it easy. It's a no-brainer. I'm still a single-handed rod guy. I only bring out the two-handed rods in the wintertime when you can't wade to some of these spots and you need to reach out. So, and the fish are just stubborn, you know. I've fished behind people and caught a fish, and I've been here an hour. You come right behind me and hook one. I said, well, you know, that happened to me yesterday. Somebody came behind me and hooked one. You know, you don't know what fly they had, a different angle to swing. Another fish might have swam into the position. But normally by summertime, they set. Unless there's rain enough to freshen up the water, they don't move much.
Okay.
It takes 6-8 inches of water to get them to move a little bit. Because they don't, this summer steelhead, they come in starting in May. They won't spawn till January, early February. Where winter steelhead, they come in, they're ripe, and they spawn within a few weeks of getting here, and then they're gone.
Huh. Interesting. I never knew that.
Our winter steelhead runs have held really strong. It's a little over 10,000 last winter. And we're expecting the same this year. And it's got a pretty good following for winter steelhead fishing.
Okay, okay. And you're talking about this volcanic bedrock rather than a gravel bottom. Where should anglers be looking you know, for holding steelhead then, with that kind of pace.
Even water, like walking speed type water, even a fast walk. Drop off ledges, rock piles, boulder piles. If you've got a rock island on some of these runs, there's a place called Split Rock, where the river splits in two separate channels almost equal. When the water tumbles down all the rapids and hits that massive rock, it backs up and creates a cushion, and there'll be fish posted right in front of that big rock and right along the sides of the ledges where there's least resistance. Anybody that's rafted, they'll know what, when they go into an obstruction, sometimes the boil water, it'll push the raft back a little bit. Well, you take that cushion down to the bottom of the river, and the speed is only in the first foot or so of the surface water, and the rest of it's, while it might be strong, it's even, and it's not pulsating.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll lay there. You just have to get your fly through that fast water, either by visibility or a larger fly or a sink tip. We're not allowed to use any weighted flies in the summer months. You can use them in the winter months, but not.
Why is that?
There was too much poaching going on. It's just one of those things that happened in stages. First, they were fishing indicators, and guys would like have cement on their feet, and they wouldn't move out of the pool for 7 hours. Well, fishing etiquette says you take half hour to an hour and move on through and let the next guy come through.
Mm-hmm.
When they started fishing super heavy flies, a really large number two nymph with the hook cut off, they're using that as a sinker, and there's no weight allowed, so they outlawed that. And, you know, I can't tell you exactly why, but it was a lot of political maneuvering. I think it was needed for the pressure that was on the river during the 70s and 80s.
Okay.
You couldn't hardly find a parking spot. And guides who weren't guides came out of the woodwork taking people's money, you know.
Yeah.
And just say, stand here. And some of those big run years, they didn't have to know much to get their clients in the fish occasionally.
Yeah, yeah.
Still up to the fish.
Yeah. When, if somebody's taking their first trip out there, what time of year offers the best combination of fish, manageable conditions, and opportunities to learn the river?
Well, I like July, because the fish are still fresh and pretty grabby. I'll chase a fly. I've seen fish chase a fly 20, 30 feet across the pool, or fly will go and swing down past it 15, 20 feet. You're just letting it hang there, and all of a sudden something clicks in that pea brain. He turns off, races off downriver and grabs your fly. You don't even think you could see it, but,
yeah,
you know, I've seen a lot of weird things more than once.
I bet.
Saw one spot. Or a guy was swinging a skunk fly, big black and white skunk, in the bright sun. Three steelhead charged that fly simultaneously, and the smallest one put on a little bit burst of extra speed and beat two larger ones to it. It was about 5 pounds or something like that. But so you never know.
So you say July's a good time for a first timer to come out there?
July is
winter.
A good. Winter time, I would say March.
Okay.
Last week of February till the third week of March.
Okay. How does your approach change from early summer, you know, fishing in June, July, to the warmer months of August and early fall?
August, September, I tend to skate flies a little more. Maybe a number six dry fly skater. I like to never go below a size 6. Even if I'm fishing a reduced size 8 on it, I'll still keep a size 6 hook. They don't know what a hook is anyway. But I've lost too many fish on a size 8 hook that just doesn't have the gap to dig into cartilage or go around a big bony lip, you know.
Yeah.
And the smaller hooks tend, if they're just caught in the edge of the flesh, they tend to kind of tear out. They'll cut themselves out. Usually, when you're trying to get it in and you pull just a little bit too hard, and whoop, the fly pulls free. Well, it usually probably just cut its way free because you pull too hard.
Uh-huh.
And that's something you see a lot of fishermen do. They'll keep the rod up in the air. When you're landing a steelhead, you should keep it down, the tip of your rod down close to the water to keep the angle closer to the fish. You'll have a better chance of not levering that hook out.
Almost like saltwater fishing. Yeah.
Yeah, it's all, pretty much the same.
Yeah. Yeah. During late summer, why are first light and arrival of the shade and the final light of evening more important than a particular fly being used?
Well, I think the fish feel a little safer in water that's not bright sunlit up. But really, I think it's more of a silhouette thing. They see the fly better silhouetted against a brighter skylight, and where the possibility at certain angles in full sun on the water, and I've caught plenty of steelhead in full sun, you're out there and you're going to try, but I've always had the most productive times early morning or late evening of fishing shaded pools until there was no more shade. Then in the sunny water, I would go to the more rapid foamy type runs.
Okay.
Where a foam curtain might give them a little cover. It's worked for me, you know.
Okay.
That's not saying I catch steelhead every time I go out, because you don't. It's just...
if you did, it wouldn't be steelhead fishing.
That's right. You've seen it. We don't see it so much anymore, but you count a dozen steelhead in a tail out, and the average is probably more like 3 to 4, depending on time of mm-hmm. year.
Yeah.
And but when they're loaded up and you've emptied everything in your fly box and you go away, scratch your head, well, why don't they bite, you know? You tried every trick you could think, but then the guy comes right behind you and slaps a fly down the wrong way. Too big a fly for the situation, and one bolts up and grabs it. There's no rhyme or reason for it.
Yeah.
That's where I got this trigger and response thing. And once I started doing... try to trigger response from a holding, these are holding steelhead, these aren't traveling steelhead. Traveling steelhead are hard to take. So I hope that answers that.
Yeah. Listen, I need to take another break here. When we come back, we'll start talking about a little bit about gear and flies and go from there. All right. Discover the power of Pure Skagit with Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics. From delicate soft tackles to hefty steelhead flies, OPST's versatile casting system meets the demands of every angling situation. With Ed Ward's unparalleled Skagit rod design and casting expertise, OPST offers you a quicker route to mastering effective casting techniques. Whether battling wind and rain or targeting steelhead, trout, or smallmouth bass, trust OPST's innovative rods, lines, and tips to elevate your fishing experience. Join the ranks of skilled anglers who rely on OPST for consistency, proficiency, and a superior fly fishing adventure. Unleash your potential with OPST today. Visit PierceGadget.com or call them at 206-858-8476. Again, that's PierceGadget.com, or you can call them at 206-858-8476. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Joe Powell about fly fishing the legendary North Umpqua for steelhead. If you'd like to ask Joe a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. Okay, we did get one question in here. A couple coming in. Joe, this one's from Phil in Kentucky. He says, how important is casting ability in the areas where you fish for steelhead?
Well, if you're fishing a single-handed rod, it's pretty important. I'm not necessarily talking distance. If you can cast 50 feet, I would call North Umpqua a medium-sized stream. It has wide sections and it's got pretty narrow slots also. But you can cast and control the line on 50 feet. You'll be able to catch fish. I like to try to find an imaginary dotted line down where the current flows. I really don't want my fly out past that, because then you lose control. Mm-hmm. But you've got to always have a faster tunnel current pushing that leader or line. And you have to bend and jerk and pull on it. And you see a lot of that with the, oh, I guess it's probably been about 10 years ago, and the two-handed rods hit the river in mass just suddenly. And they don't fish the close lies. They get up knee-deep in the water and fling it as far as they can throw it. And they catch fish, but they don't catch any more as a good single-handed fly rod that knows how to control the line. And that's not saying there aren't good two-handed rod fishermen that know what they're doing. I know some of them, and they will fish the close spots first.
Phil also had another follow-up question about how can a non-expert tell how long a steelhead has been in the ocean? You know, whether they're 1, 2, 3, 4 year.
Well, you can't without, nobody can, unless they pull a scale down between the, right around the adipose, between the dorsal and the adipose area, down off the side flank, and have a biologist or know how to read the scale. Those fish scales are like tree rings, and they tell you lean times when they've been in fresh water and bountiful times when they've been in the ocean, and they fed more, and so they grow more. So just because you catch a 5-pound steelhead or a 16-pound steelhead, they might both be two salt fish.
Ah, I see.
I had a friend catch a summer fish, 16 pounds, which is a nice fish for this river, and or any river, really, but he pulled a couple of scales, sent them into Fish and Wildlife, and kind of had a little, not a bet, but just a, he was saying, I just know that's a three salt fish. I said, one thing I know is that fish are like people. Some eat more than others. I bet you it's a two salt. I bet you it's a two salt fish. And it came back, it was a two salt fish. It had only been in the ocean 2 years. So it found a very productive feeding line where maybe the 5-pounder didn't.
Yeah.
Or the 5-pounder went out a month or 6 weeks later than the early one.
Yeah. One's feeding at the smorgasbord and the other's at the salad bar, right?
Yeah, and one might just might get late for dinner, you know. The fish don't hatch out when they go through that smolting process, and then 2 years they suddenly go, oh, time to go to the ocean.
Yeah.
They start meandering downstream and they trickle out over a period of months. Well, one that just really has a built-in innate urge to go, he'll be in the ocean in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
It might take a month or better, or 6 weeks for the other fish. And
right.
The one that gets to the table first eats better, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Now, you started to talk about rods and lines and so forth. So what type, and you had kind of said you favor the single-handed, I think, but what type and weight rods and lines do you recommend?
I fish a 10-foot 9-weight. And as I've gotten older, a 10-foot 8-weight for a dry fly is easier on the arm. But I had a friend who fished a 7-weight 10-foot all the time. But I also saw him wear out 3 rods, you know. So I would say a minimum would be an 8-weight for a steelhead.
Okay.
If you're on the Rogue River and they have a lot of half-pounders that are fish that are 14 to 18, maybe a big one would be 20 inches. Then a 7-weight would be fine.
Mm-hmm.
I know people who fish even lighter line weights, but then what happens if you hook a real big one, you know?
Yeah. Jason in Kentucky is asking, if you only have a single-handed rod, can you fish most of the river by wading?
You can. It would, it's, like I said, it's a difficult river. There's a highway that goes for 33 miles. You can pull off and fish any productive water, but not all water is productive. But some of those pools have to be waded. There's no other way. Or you have to be on the other side of the river. There is a trail system. There are some people who will take a little rubber dinghy and go across the river because it's better fished from the opposite side, and they don't want to walk 2 miles from the nearest bridge, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So A first-time person, I would say get a good guide. There's not many of them around anymore, but there's still a couple, but they're down on the road, and they come up here and guide on the Umpqua occasionally.
Okay. Any particular recommendations for footwear or safety precautions because of the...
Studded boots.
Studded, okay.
Has to be straight felt, get you by on cobble, but not water-worn, slick bedrock.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen people step into the current, flat piece of rock, and a current pushes them 20 feet downriver.
Like a slow
slide.
Oh, geez.
They were in no danger. They start heading into rough rock, waist deep water. There's a lot of pressure on you.
Okay, let's talk about
definitely studded boots and definitely a waiting staff.
And a waiting staff. Okay.
You've always got 2 points of contact on the river bottom that way.
Yeah. You've got a lot of fly patterns in your book, and I know, like we talked about early in your bio, you have a lot with Umpqua. Which ones do you... let me just skip to the next one. If you were assembling separate fly boxes for summer and winter, what patterns and colors would you consider essential for each of those seasons?
Well, with the winter steelhead, I would add a lead-eyed leech, which is legal in those months, because the water's high and roily and often off color. And as far as the standard size or standard patterns, same patterns that you would use in the summer, but larger. So in the wintertime, you're fishing size 1/0, size 2/0. I've caught steelhead on 5/0 general practitioners, which the fly is like 4.5 to 5 inches long. You know, they eat stuff bigger than that in the ocean. And just because you've got 2.5 inches of wispy orange bucktail off the end of a big hook, they're going to take the whole thing. So I've never found that to be a real problem. But I would definitely say larger sizes. You look in a lot of these fly books, cat pattern books, you see a very predominance of darker colors. It doesn't mean there isn't the yellows and the oranges and the reds and the pinks and all the combinations of that. There are, and they work at times. Those are my wild-card flies that, I've been doing nothing but black or gray or something in between and try some of those oddball things, and you'll save the day often, more so in the summertime than the winter. Winter's definitely visibility, so a larger profile helps. And they fish a lot of heavier tips in the winter. But because it's so rocky in places, and if you're not familiar with it, you might lose a few flies. And I've known people to lose tips also.
Oh, well.
I mean, it's happened to me where I had to wrap the line around my elbow and back off to the bank, and the line broke behind the tip.
Wow.
So I spliced in. I always carry extra stuff, but you splice in a loop and put your new tip on and keep fishing.
Yeah. We had a question come in from Roy Morris-East asking, do you fish the Skykomish Sunrise dry?
I don't personally. I guess I'm going to... I don't know everything, you know. I've never heard of a Skykomish Sunrise dry. I've known people to fish it, and I sold it at my shop, as a wet fly, which it was originally intended. And I've guided a couple of people who that was their favorite fly, because that's what they caught all their fish on, because that's the only thing they ever tied on the end of the leader.
And
I got them switched over to black, dark flies, and I think you'll do better.
Okay.
Wintertime, I would add the hot pinks also, by the way. About a hot baby pink, not cerise, not red, just a baby pink lead-eyed leech. It's caught fish behind when they ignore black.
Interesting, yeah. Scott in Florida, he wrote in and says, I have fished the Great Lakes region for steelhead and found that purple and white were the most popular colors of flies. Does that still maintain out west for steelhead?
To some degree, I personally like purple in June and again in October, or actually even mid-September through October. I'll still fish the black flies, but there's a lot in the fall. There's a lot of wind and dead leaves and different decayed matter that's being blown into the water, especially leaves. And a black fly can get lost pretty easily, but a purple fly they can pick out. So I do like purple and white under those circumstances, and I think it's just the brightness of the pattern in June, because the fish are brush in, and they will, if they're holding, they're more likely to take just the first thing they see. And the purple and whites are easy to see.
In your book, you emphasize slowing the fly down, especially in faster water. Can you explain how casting angle, line control, and upstream mends work together to create productive swing that you want?
Yeah, you know, keeping in mind that there are different currents, whether it's coming into you or going away from you, and the current that's going turning away from you is the hardest current to fish. But by mending, or by casting a basic 45-degree angle, say, and you know where their main drift line is, you're keeping in line with that, because the fish aren't going to be too far off of that until the water pools out or dumps out. But when it pulls out, then the current spreads and evens out more, so they could be bank to bank. But by mending upstream and holding your fly rod upstream and low to the water, once you're sure that fly has pulled around, I only usually try to do one mend, sometimes two, sometimes three if I'm trying to position the fly to a certain point. And then I can back that fly down just like they would from a drift boat on a plug or something. And I can stop it. You will come to a point where that fly is either holding still in the water, it's not moving, it's just hanging, and that's the time people want to mend or do something. That's the time you don't touch it. When that fly is hanging like that and it starts to move again, that's when the fish often will boil up and take it. They see it. So if the current catches their line in a big boil of water, and if you were to mend, you'd take it out of that fish zone, you just leave it there as long as you can, and then dip your rod from upstream towards the water to the downstream position, and you've automatically put that line upstream on the mend and your line downstream, and you'll get another, depending on the speed of the current, 3 to 6 feet of holding drift, if you want to call it that. But then when it bellies out, that fly fires out of there like a rocket. There's no stopping it. But you've covered all your... This is so you're not jerking on the fly so much in your primary line.
Yeah, okay.
And there's times when last resort, primary lies, I'll take the fly and slap it right down on top of them, 2 or 3 feet in front of them. But I don't mend, I don't do anything. Hit it hard enough so you've got a bunch of S-curves in the line, and that current will straighten it out, and it'll drift on its own, and I've taken numbers to it like that. When I spot that thing down, like, hey, look at this, you know, get it,
right.
Pay attention. Well, sometimes they do, and sometimes nothing works. I watched a fish not too far up from the house one time, pretty nice fish, bright sun. Never made a move for the fly. And when they're laying and they're corking up and down and moving side to side, if you don't spook them, that fish has a, you have a real good chance of taking that fish. If he's holding right on the bottom, the belly never touches the rocks, by the way, but if they're right still on the bottom, he's comfortable, he's not going to move, your chances are cut by 50-60%. So I run this fly, and I do it upstream, which is not a necessarily recommended way to catch a steelhead, but dead drift, so I kept back sacking the line, and I watch this fly sink, hit him in the nose, roll over his back, and pull away. I reeled up, and after the next cast, I did the same thing. Here comes the fly. The fish moves over about 8 inches, lets the fly go by, and moves right back to where he was. I mean, this actually happened. I went, that's when I reeled up, and I went, that fish can't be taken. So, yeah, you know, there's trigger response. You just never know what they're going to take.
Yeah. Well, we're running out of time here. We've got about 12 minutes left to go here. But okay. I want to talk about some of the productive pools. I mean, in your book, I think you named somewhere around 130, you know, uniquely named pools, riffles, runs, bridges, camp water sections, different areas. And we can't possibly talk about all those
tonight.
No. Yeah. But let's kind of just dig into a couple here that I made note of. Deadline, the Flats, and Famous are the first major pools in the fly-only water.
Right. That's where the fly fishing area begins. Mm-hmm. And all three of those runs can be fished dry in your street shoes, if you want. You don't have to have waders.
I've seen
people out in the middle of the river at Famous and the Flats. They're stepping on fish when they do that, if they're belly deep in the water. And so, but those three runs can be fished easily. I haven't fished it recently, no.
No, do you fish them differently? Are they?
No, they're, the Famous pool is a, comes out of a long, slow, wide, deep section of river. And there's a submerged basalt dike runs across a river and stops that flow, and it's like spilling over the top of a bowl. And there's one rocky, dry rock in the summer, not in the winter, but and with a submerged ledge, and right in behind that rock, it's maybe a 30-foot cast at best. It's one of those spots so that you can just put it down and you don't mind, you just leave it alone. See what the current's going to do with your fly first few casts. And sometimes you can just change angle of your cast to and never have to bend. And it's a short drift, and then it just spills over to a heavy rapids for 150 yards or something like that. Then it opens up into what they call the flats, and it's a wide, riffly, boulders, bedrock bottom, cobble bottom. It's got a little bit of everything. Well, the cobble can change from year to year, but the bedrock doesn't. And so, but it's not all that deep. So I would fish them the same. So there is more mending there. And Deadline is one mend at the best, unless you're trying to position a fly to a certain point.
I think you wrote that Famous Pool has provided some of your best exciting dry fly fishing. Is that the case?
Yeah. Well, partly because I'm so close to the house and I fish it so often. And I've got that advantage where I could just, when I had the shop going, which I closed it in 2010 after 30 years, but get up early, go up and try to hit those three runs before I had to get back and open the shop at 8 o'clock. And people knew my rig, and my shoulders would just kind of hunch when I'd be there fishing, and some guy, I hear a car door, and down through the bushes he comes. And I thought that was you. I know it's too early, but it sure make it worth your while if you go out early and open the shop for me. So I always did, you know. And he goes in and he buys 2 liters. Well, I don't have time to go out and fish again, but one time I had just landed about a 7-pound buck after about the third cast, and I went, I got 3 more runs to go. I heard the car door again. I never did get to fish those other couple of runs.
Jeez.
But I got
I've never
fish.
Heard of that. Yeah.
Got my fish for the day. It's all part of the business.
Yeah. The other others that I have down here, Baker Falls, Lower Baker, Middle Baker, Winter Hole, and Clay Creek Riffle. They all have, I guess, different fishing situations in a relatively compact area.
Sure.
How do you decide which ones to fish?
Well, I like about Baker Falls, personally. I haven't done as well below the falls. It's pretty easy to fish. You can't wait it. The other spot you have to wait out to. And the place we call Winter Hole, it's a little thin on the water for my liking for summer fish. Not so in June, but after the water takes a drop. But it's an excellent spot when the water's up in the wintertime. The fish are all in a bathtub. They come around that little curve and they hold in about a 12 by 14 foot area, and that's where they're going to be. I could count the fish on one hand that I've caught outside of that area. It happens, but not very often, and probably due more to water level than anything.
Yeah.
So.
You describe Boundary Pool as an early morning or late evening favorite that may remain shaded well into the morning. What makes it productive, and how should an angler approach it?
Well, it's not one of my more productive places. I've caught a number of fish there over the years. I've had some really good experiences there. But it doesn't go into the sun till, stays in the shade, I should say, till about 11 o'clock in the morning, because there's a big high ridge. And while the rest of the river is starting to flood with sunlight, it's one of a half a dozen spots that you can find shade on till about 11 o'clock. And I like fishing shaded pools.
Yeah,
I tell people
generally, yeah.
it's just because I don't want to stand out there sweating in waders, you know. If they get really hot.
Yeah, it's the only air conditioning you can find out there, huh? Yeah.
Yeah, so I fish the shade.
Yeah. I actually made note here, it says the stretch reached from the Mont Segment Trail includes Split Rock, Burnham Pool, Lower Burnham, Laurie's Run, Leaning Tree and Ledges, and Nouse Pool. But that has been a productive area. Which of these would you recommend to a first-time visitor, and why?
Well, they're difficult to fish from the highway side. Split Rock, you can't wade it, but the way the water runs towards you, it takes somebody either with a long rod or to fish that far ledge or to get that center cushion set upright. And then you have to be way up where the whitewater is, what I call the angle of the dangle. So that line is not going to be developing a big curve and snatching the fly out when I want it to stay. But all of those from the opposite side of the river, it's either a 2 mile walk roughly down from Mott Bridge, and you either don't get in the water or you're ankle deep in the water. They're very easy to fish, and I think it's more protective from the trail side.
Okay.
And but you I have taken float tubes and little rubber rafts across below Split Rock. Just make sure you start high enough to scooch across fast enough before you end up in the middle of where you're going to fish. And
But in general, you're not floating this river. It's a wade.
no, it's not allowed to
But
float
you are,
fish.
it's legal to take a little dinghy across, huh?
You can do that. And
You just can't float.
you can raft or kayak the river. I've got one friend who uses a paddleboard, but he still thinks he's part mountain goat or something. But now he's just turned 50, so he's still young.
Finish up here with the Camp Water area. It includes legendary names like Glory, the Mott Water, Kitchen, Boat Pool Station, Hayden's Run, Sawtooth, Millionaire, and Surveyor. If an angler had only one day to explore this historic section, how would you help them
Well,
prioritize these pools?
you would have time to, unless there's other anglers around, you'd have to wait your turn or skip ahead. You never cut in front of someone without saying, "You mind if I go down and fish the next pool?" Because he might be ready to reel out and headed that way anyway. It's just a polite thing to do. I'm not saying that's the way people do it anymore, but they used to. My personal favorites, if I wanted a quick fish, I would fish the Boat Pool, the Kitchen, and the Mott's. And then forget Glory. Nobody fishes that much anymore. It's it holds some fish early, but it's a difficult weight. And if you flip, you go over a big cataract falls.
God, so, okay.
You know,
yeah.
That's something
things to consider.
That's something I did when you were 18 or 20 years old, but not now, you know. So it's something to consider, is right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So those three, and if the runs are open, I would fish Station on the way out and Hayden's Run.
Mm-hmm.
Back okay. up to the parking lot.
Yeah. Is that a full day's fishing there, would you think?
Or no, I'd call that out about 3 or 4 hours.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I tend to fish a little faster.
Okay.
Now I fish slower.
Now you, yeah. I wade slower.
Yeah, I'm wade slower, yeah.
And many times saying to my son, hey, can you come over here and help me a little bit?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, we got to wrap it up here. But hang tight with me here, Joe, because we're going to give away your book. I want you around for that. We're going to give away a couple other prizes here. We're going to give a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. And like I just said, a copy of your book, Fly Fishing Guide to the North Umpqua, courtesy of Stackpole Books. So hang tight, and we'll be right back, and we'll give those prizes away.
Okay.
The Bonefish and Tarpon Trust works very hard to safeguard the future of our beloved flats fisheries from protecting spawning sites threatened by unsustainable fishing pressure to securing historic funding to restore Florida's Everglades and estuaries. Thanks to their members, they've expanded their conservation to the Bahamas, Belize, and Mexico. There's still much more work to be done, and they need your help. With your support, they can ensure that the flats fishery is healthy and sustainable now and for generations to come. Visit btt.org and become a member of the Bonefish and Tarpon Trust today. Again, that's btt.org. Just a reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, "What did you think of this show?" Just click on the link and leave your comments, and we'd really appreciate it. Now's the time to give away our prizes. The winners for our drawings are randomly selected from a show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show by now, it's too late, but make sure you do so for our next show so you don't miss out on your chance at the great prizes we have to offer. If you are one of the lucky winners, we will contact you after the show to collect the information so that we can deliver your prize to you. First thing we'll be giving away is a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International. To learn more about FFI, go to flyfishersinternational.org, flyfishersinternational.org. And great, great organization to support. Our winner for that is, let me get down there, is Robert Cartier in Connecticut. So, Robert, congratulations. You just won a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International. And now we'll give away a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. And to learn more about Trout Unlimited, go to tu.org. Again, another great organization to support. And our winner for that is Mike Giavidani, and he's in Alabama. So there you go, Mike. Congrats on winning your membership to Trout Unlimited. And now we'll give away a copy of Joe's book, Fly Fishing Guide to North Umpqua, courtesy of Stackpole Books. And the way we do this is I got to clear my queue here, make sure there's no questions in there. It looks good. Okay, so the form on our homepage is where you provide your answer, and first person that gets it correct will win Joe's book, Fly Fishing Guide to the North Umpqua. All right, so the question is, there was one area of the North Umpqua that was historical and kind of the center of attention. What's the name of that area? And Joe, there's a little delay before they hear the question, and then they have to type the answer. So we have to dance and entertain them in the meantime.
All right.
And I think they type slower than they tie flies, so that's the other problem.
Yep.
So, yeah. So let's see if we got a winner here yet. And checking. Okay, and we have our first one come in here. Phil in Kentucky, a longtime listener, says camp water. Is he correct?
He is correct.
He's correct. Okay, there you go. Phil, another one for your library. You need to get out there and go fishing, it sounds like. So, Phil, send me your address, please, again, and we'll get you. We'll get Stackpole to send that out to you. And another answer came in with steamboats. One question I wanted to ask you is how did the name steamboats get? Were there steamboats that went up this river at one time? Or?
The way the story goes, because I wasn't around when that happened, but they used to gold mine up in the Bohemia, up the headwaters of Steamboat Creek. And when the gold miners left, either couldn't find gold, and they called it, it was steamboated out. And they headed for another area. Or in the cases of the Mississippi, they took the steamboat points beyond, I guess, you know.
Yeah, just curious, because it doesn't sound like a big enough river for steamboats to be going up.
No, it's not. It was a gold mining term.
Yeah.
It's steamboated out. It's time to leave.
Yeah. Cool. Interesting. All right. Well, Joe, hey, I appreciate you being with us tonight and sharing your knowledge over all the years you fished this area. Great, great bank of knowledge. And like you said, you love to share this when others haven't. And so thank you for sharing with us tonight.
Well, thank you for having us, or me.
Now, everybody, I hope you found our podcast archive on our website. If you haven't, look for the link on the top line menu. In the archive, you'll find all of our shows, over 440 shows now that you can search by keyword or keyword phrase like trout, tarpon, North Umpqua River, and so forth. So go ahead and explore. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised at what you discover out there. Our next broadcast will be on September 16th. At 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, I'll be interviewing Steve Colton. And the show will be Fly Fishing the Farmington River, Trout Hatches and Tactics. Connecticut's Farmington River offers outstanding year-round trout fishing, but consistently catching its trout requires understanding the river, its hatches, and how the fish respond to changing conditions. Steve joins us to share his hard-earned knowledge of this celebrated fishery. And we'll explore where and when to fish, seasonal strategies, important hatches, productive flies, and techniques ranging from dry flies and nymphs to wet flies and streamers. Whether it's your first trip or your 15th, Steve will help you fish the Farmington more effectively. So be sure and add this upcoming show to your calendar right under Steve's picture on our homepage. It says Add to Calendar button. Click on that, add it to your favorite calendar, and you'll be all set. We would like to thank Fly Fishers International, Trout Unlimited, Bonefish and Tarpon Trust, Olympic Peninsula's Gadget Tactics, the Ugly Bug Fly Shop for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.